Hello, this is William Fink, and this is Christigenia Internet Radio. Today is Friday, September 22nd, 2023. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. This evening, we are going to present part 30 of our commentary on the book of Genesis. It will cover all of Genesis chapter 20, and it is titled, The Consequences of Covetousness. I almost titled this program The Consequences of Concupiscence, but I thought that was too much of a tongue twister. So I had changed it after I made up my mind in the first place. Most modern white Europeans, whom today are often led to believe that they live in a post-Christian society, still take for granted the Christian values with which they were raised, or at least with which their grandparents or great-grandparents were raised, without any conception of the degree of depravity which was prevalent throughout much of the pre-Christian or non-Christian worlds. Yet those Christian values, which had been shared by Europeans for well over 1,000 years, and in many cases close to 2,000 years, have become ingrained within us through generations of childhood education and practice, and they remain in us and in our laws, even if we may no longer consider ourselves to be Christians. Then, with the advent of colonialism from about the 15th century, Europeans brought those values with them, by which they had governed all of their colonies abroad, as well as having transmitted them to the non-white races whom they had also come to govern. The non-white races, however, and especially the Negro races, do not maintain them very well in post-colonial modern society. And in fact, they never really submitted to Christian values, even when they were governed by them. Today, any Negroes in Africa who maintain any semblance of Christian values do so only as long as there is wave after wave of white missionaries or international church officials dispensing rewards for their good behavior. When I was a child, before 1970, there were no pickup bars because women were not even permitted in most bars. Some bars had a back room with dining tables, even if they did not serve food, in which women were permitted if they had a man to escort them. Those rooms had separate entrances, usually on the side street, and signs above or near the back door would explicitly label it a ladies' entrance. Otherwise, any ladies entering through the bar door or without an escort, would never be served. My father could take me, even at 5 or 6 years old, through the front door to sit at the bar. But he could not take my mother. She couldn't go in that front door. Back then, my father had also taught me not to even speak to a girl unless I had been introduced to her by her parents. And I would never think of making sexual advances towards any girl. At least most, if not all, of the other boys I knew were raised with those same values. But then, of course, we were also instilled with other basic Christian values, such as not to steal, or to lie, or to abuse those weaker than ourselves. At least most of the other boys disdained perverts, and especially sodomites. And if they did not disdain them, they dare not make any mention of it, or they would also become the targets of the same chastisement which the sodomites had been. In other words, in those days we bullied faggots, and everybody who sympathized with them. But with the so-called sexual revolution of the late 1960s, and the so-called women's liberation movement, which seemed to follow it almost immediately, By the time I was in my late teens, in the late 1970s, all those Christian ethics seemed to have broken down. It suddenly began to be acceptable, to a degree, to be a sodomite, and they began to emerge from the proverbial closet. Their having been accepted began to multiply their numbers. Women began hanging out in bars, and the so-called pickup culture became a popular lifestyle option. When I was young, I often worked with my father, and he would always bring me to bars after work. Perhaps I was 11 or 12, when on certain occasions I witnessed women in bars taking off their bras and flinging them or hanging them from fixtures. These women, who were often in their 50s or 60s, so it was a horrible sight, usually, were gleeful that they could now hang out in bars and whore around with impunity. Young ladies, or really older girls, who were once expected to be virgins until they were married, all became targets for the covetousness of prowling men who were more than happy to make them numbers in their long list of conquests. With the introduction of no-fault divorce at abortion clinics around that same time, and the more ancient but false concept that marriage only happened in a church, there was no longer any prohibition against unbridled concupiscence. If you don't know what concupiscence is, it's strong sexual lust or desire. And I believe the word appears in the King James Version, even in the letters of Paul, perhaps. I was born in 1960, barely soon enough to remember what life was like before the depravity of the hippie culture of Woodstock, or reflected by Woodstock. And the 1960s had fully spread throughout society. That only took a few years for the values of Woodstock to be promoted incessantly by the media and spread throughout the entire society. And I was barely old enough to have learned some Christian values and come to appreciate them before the whole world around me changed quite drastically over a period of perhaps 10 or 15 years. Even my own father, who had taught me better, had made some wrong turns once women became regular denizens of the bars which he had frequented. Then at the end of that period of my life, another phenomenon I noticed, but not until I was in my early 20s and had spent considerable time around them, is that Negroes, and also the recently immigrated, at that time, Hispanics and other non-whites, had never shared the values with which at least most of the white folks whom I knew had been raised. Even where those non-whites had professed to be Christians, or at least Catholics, in the case of most Hispanics. They claim to be Catholics, and they worship the Virgin and not the Christ. Therefore, being accepted in large numbers among whites in workplaces and in social events, something which was not common in the Northeast before the 1970s, the white population slowly became a playground for an army of indubitably lustful and soulless beasts. Of course, we see the results of that situation today as it continues to exacerbate. In retrospect, it seems to me that in the 15 years from 1967 to 1982, perhaps, dates which may seem arbitrary to other people, the world of Mayberry was plunged directly into Sodom. From my own personal experience, I can honestly state that the rape of women and children and sexual relations with prepubescent or barely pubescent girls, and sometimes even boys, is common, and it is often even considered to be normal in Negro and Hispanic communities. And I have direct experience with that. And it is only punished when it is noticed by the governmental institutions which were originally founded by white Christians. The sexualization of children in those same communities at even younger ages is also normal. And there are countless examples of it in modern social media. This is why, ever since its inception, the so-called LGBT movement, and I'm not going to add the rest of the vowels, has sought alliances with Marxists, Negroes, and Hispanic activists, and those of other races in the so-called Rainbow Coalition. They are natural allies, because Christian laws and principles are inimical to them all. It is also not a coincidence that the sexualization of children and the commission of sexual acts with children as young as 3 years old is expressly permitted in the Jewish Talmud. The rabbis of the Talmud have also claimed that there were seven genders. As long as 1,500 years ago, in spite of the fact that there are only two genders found in the Torah. So it is also not a coincidence that the LGBT movement, of which Jews have always been at the vanguard, pushes for the legalization of pederasty and drag queen story hour. So growing up just a couple of miles from downtown Manhattan, in what had, after the Immigration Act of 1968 especially, in what had quickly become the largest cesspool of multiculturalism in the West at that time, today London might rival it, or Paris, seems in hindsight like witnessing the development of Sodom. But since there were 1.5 million Jewish immigrants in New York already by 1914, Jews whom many unsuspecting white Christians imagine were just like them in at least most respects, that cesspool was spilled out of a cauldron which had simmered for nearly a century before it actually became noticeable as the heat was turned up and it started to boil. Of course, rural folks and folks from small towns that managed to remain predominantly white for a much longer time generally did not have this same experience, and some rural people I have known have only stared incredulously as I tried to describe it to them. So even if they recognize the fact that things have changed on one level or another, they remain ignorant as to why they have changed, because they cannot believe the true underlying reasons behind the change. For those of us who are more aware, we may all lament the loss of some yesterday, as many older Christians recollect living in a better world which has existed in one place or another in decades past. But the truth is that the groundwork for the circumstances which brought the Negro chimpouts and the exhibitions of sexual depravity in the late 1960s had been laid in the civil rights movements of the 1950s, which in turn had been coming to a slow boil since Christian Southerners had rejected Yankee Reconstruction and sought to preserve their culture by instituting the so-called Jim Crow laws in the late 19th century. But before that, there was the so-called Civil War. And before that, there was the emancipation of Jewry and the introduction of a godless state in France which had accommodated Jewry, and which popularized and propagated the false concepts of liberty, equality, and fraternity in spite of the failures of France itself. Those ideals are impossible to attain and represent the Jewish gaslighting of Christian society through which Jews have hoped to destroy that society. Then, even earlier, there was the so-called Glorious Revolution, which reopened England to Jewry in the 17th century, and the spread of the Jewish Kabbalah throughout European academia and the sciences, in the 15th and 16th centuries. Without any of these things, today's circumstances would not have been possible. So even aside from all of the wars, there were many lost yesterdays and many lost memories of what was a seemingly normal society. And we can pick and choose earlier moments in the slide towards Sodom, which have occurred throughout history, all the way back to Genesis chapter 3. But for our white European race, we can go back no further than that. We had been simmering in a low country boil full of unclean beasts ever since the pronouncements of Genesis 3:15. The problem is that we keep choosing to eat of those beasts. Therefore, it is not a coincidence that the common denominator, which has ignited or empowered all of these events throughout history, is the Jew. And in his own literature, the Jew is proud of his accomplishments as he endeavors to eradicate Christianity completely. In the end, they will all wind up just as Sodom and Gomorrah, as it is described here in Genesis chapter 19. We have been warned, as we are told by Yahshua Christ himself in the Revelation, that the current world would indeed resemble Sodom and Egypt. Sodom represents sexual corruption and depravity, and Egypt represents the oppression and captivity of the children of God in this evil world system, which he himself had called Mystery Babylon. So it is no coincidence that the methods of operation in the plan for Jewish supremacy are outlined in the Babylonian Talmud and have been instilled into willing Christian dupes through mystery cults such as the Lodges of Freemasonry or the Jesuit organization, which has embedded itself within the Roman Catholic Church. So the Jew, the descendant of the ancient Nephilim, who were at least partly responsible for Sodom and Gomorrah, is the driving force today behind what the Revelation identifies as Sodom and Egypt, where our Lord was slain, or crucified, perhaps. I don't remember the exact wording. While we do not know at what time it will be or precisely how it shall happen, it is indisputable that one day soon we shall once again see the end of Sodom. And this final time, it will be ended for good, as the true children of Israel are once again delivered from captivity. Now, in the life of Abraham, at the commencement of Genesis chapter 20, in the aftermath of the destruction of Sodom, we have some examples of the consequences of covetousness, in which there are also lessons which are relevant today, as well as being relevant to understanding some aspects of the pre-Christian world. So with verse 1, "And Abraham journeyed from thence. He left Hebron, from where he saw the fires rising from Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities of the plain. And Abraham journeyed from thence toward the south country, and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur, and sojourned in Gerar." There was a Kadesh which had been mentioned in Genesis chapter 14, which was among the places smitten by the kings of Elam and Mesopotamia before they had looted Sodom. That Kadesh was evidently in Galilee, and it may be identified with the Kadesh in Galilee, which was later a part of the inheritance of the tribe of Naphtali, and also a Levitical city of refuge, mentioned in Joshua chapters 20 and 21. Where the phrase Kadesh in Galilee appears, the name is always spelled with an E in the first syllable, as the second letter, rather than an A, but otherwise the name is spelled either way. The name Kadesh or Kedesh is from a Hebrew word translated as Kadesh, Kadash, or Kadash, which means holy or separate. And therefore, Kadesh as a place name designates a place which was considered holy, so it most likely was the site of an ancient temple or a center of worship for some pagan cult. This Kadesh here in Genesis, here in Genesis chapter 20, I should say, is not in Galilee, but in the south, so it was a different center of idolatry, evidently. And it is also sometimes spelled Kadesh with an E in the typically inconsistent King James Version. It was situated in the southern portion of the land, which had later fallen by lot to the tribe of Judah, as it is described in Joshua chapter 15. In that same chapter, and on other occasions, such as in Numbers chapters 32 and 34, it is also called Kadesh Barnea. The name Shur, which we see here, this is an interesting name, from a Hebrew word, Shur, which means wall, certainly must refer to the ancient fortification called the Prince's Wall. The Prince's Wall is known from the ancient Egyptian story of Sinuhe, which is dated to the first half of the 20th century BC. And also from other historical sources. So it existed at least 100 years before the birth of Abraham. It was a fortified wall that controlled access into and out of Egypt from the east, and it was built along the eastern side of the Nile Delta, running southwards from Pelusium, which is actually a Roman name. Ancient Pelusium was a city east of the easternmost branch of the Nile, at the corner of the delta on the Mediterranean Sea. Today it's actually inland because of the silting up of the Nile. The delta has moved out into the sea, in other words. It was sometimes called Per Amun by the Egyptians, or sometimes Senna, and therefore in the Bible the city was sometimes called Sin. In the King James Version, from a word of uncertain meaning, which was evidently a transliteration of Senna. And the land around it was called the Wilderness of Sin, for example, in Exodus chapters 16 and 17. The word Shur is wall, and it is mentioned six times in Scripture, in Genesis, Exodus, and 1 Samuel, or 1 Samuel. This wall figures prominently in understanding the reasons for the crossing of the Red Sea and in determining the route of the Exodus. The area east of the wall was considered the Wilderness of Shur, which is mentioned in Exodus chapter 15, verse 22. That passage serves to demonstrate the fact that the crossing of the Red Sea must have been at some point in the Gulf of Suez, and it was necessary to get around the Prince's Wall. Having made the crossing, the children of Israel would have turned right, or north, into the wilderness of Shur, because they would next have to go around the Gulf of Aqaba to proceed into Palestine, which was their destination. In some contexts, it might appear that Shur was also the name of a town in the same area. So we read in Genesis chapter 25 of the death of Ishmael. And these are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years. And he gave up the ghost and died, and was gathered unto his people. And they dwelt from Havilah unto Shur, that is, before Egypt, as thou goest towards Assyria. So if you're in Shur, near the Prince's Wall, upon which the other side is Egypt, and you're going north around the eastern side of the Dead Sea, you're going toward Assyria. And that is where Havilah is, as we learn later in Scripture, in the book of Judges or Joshua, I forget which. And he died in the presence of all his brethren. So the Ishmaelites dwelt from Shur around the eastern side of the Dead Sea at the time when Ishmael died. The ancient Greek historian Diodor Siculus described remnants of what was called the Prince's Wall in Book 1 of his Library of History, where he wrote in part that the wall extended through the desert from Pelusium to Heliopolis, and its length was some 1,500 stades. A stade is a Greek stadion. That would be a distance, 1,500 of them, of over 170 miles if Llewellyn Scott are correct in measuring a Greek stadion at 606.75 English feet. I believe that they are correct. Unless the wall took a winding path, the distance by straight line is actually only about 100 miles from the site of ancient Heliopolis to the site of ancient Sin, which was called Pelusium by the Greeks and Romans. As we shall learn later in this chapter, Abimelech, whom Abraham shall encounter here in this chapter, was a Philistine. And the Philistines were a seafaring people. So therefore, it is evident that Gerar would have been somewhere on the coast between the site of the ancient cities of the Philistines and the Prince's Wall, which terminated at Pelusium, or Sin. Modern attempts to identify the site of ancient Gerar with the site in the south of Judah called Tel Haror are both contrary to scripture and to the characteristics of the Philistines, because Tel Haror is an inland hill. It is much more likely that Gerar should be identified with some city near Gaza. Much later, Gerar and its cities are mentioned in 2 Chronicles chapter 14, where after Israel had suffered an invasion of Cushites, called Ethiopians in the King James Version, having repelled them, the children of Israel pursued them to Gerar and spoiled the cities thereof, which were described as having had exceedingly much spoil, so they must have been quite wealthy. Many years later, a Judean employed by the Ethiopians, or Cushites, in Gaza, in Acts chapter 8, had worked directly for their queen. Since the word Gaza is a Persian word, which is said to mean treasure, it is apparent from these passages that Gerar was an ancient name for Gaza. So Cushites, or Ethiopians, as the Greek called them in both Mesopotamia and Africa, must have had a presence in Gaza for many centuries after the Philistine period. This also seems to agree with the assertion that Gerar must have been on the coast and not deep in the interior, which was only wilderness. Now, in a very concise account, Abraham encounters the Philistine king. And Abraham said of Sarah his wife, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. There is a longer version of this verse in the Greek Septuagint, which Brenton translates as follows. "And Abraham said concerning Sarah his wife, 'She is my sister.' For he feared to say, 'She is my wife,' lest at any time the men of the city should kill him for her sake," in other words, to take her. So Abimelech, king of Gerara, sent and took Sarah. In part 22 of this commentary, titled The Sojourn, we discussed an episode very similar to this one, which is found in Genesis chapter 12. There, Abraham went to Egypt and was caught in a situation with the Pharaoh, which is identical to this one with Abimelech. An older Isaac will be caught in a similar circumstance with a Philistine king who was also named Abimelech, but who was not necessarily this Abimelech, and rather perhaps his son or some other successor, later in Genesis chapter 26. These accounts are sometimes dismissed by critics as fabrications, since they are almost repetitive. However, they fully reflect the arrogance of ancient kings, the absolute power which they had within their own kingdoms, their ability to fulfill their covetousness, the limits of their concupiscence in the shadow of fear of a god of judgment, to at least some degree, and also the fact that Yahweh God can and will do anything to ensure the outcome and veracity of his promises. Furthermore, there have been other critics of these accounts who claim that Abraham and Isaac had willingly given their wives up to these kings in order to gain some advantage for themselves, as if they were callous Jews. These critics are absolutely ignorant of ancient history and the rights which were asserted by kings in the ancient world, which were commonly recognized by the subjects of those kings. So if any of the personalities in these accounts exhibited typically Jewish behavior, it is the pagan kings, and neither Abraham nor Isaac. It is quite credible that if Sarah and Rebecca were the beautiful women which they were described to have been, that ancient kings would have lusted after them and moved to fulfill that lust without consequences once they heard that the women were maidens, that they were his sister. Here Abraham had told the same half-truth which he had earlier told to the Pharaoh in Egypt. And he must have thought that it had helped him then, in spite of the fact that his having lied by his omission was revealed. Perhaps because it delayed any trouble he may have suffered until Yahweh God would intervene on his behalf. So Abraham made the same omission here. And while in reality it was certainly not necessary, Abraham, within the limits of his own knowledge and experience, must have thought it to be expedient. So for that we cannot judge Abraham, not having walked in his shoes. In the end, Yahweh did not judge Abraham for having done that. Isaac will follow in the same half-truth, as it is recorded in Genesis chapter 26. As we had also discussed in our presentation of the sojourn, Genesis chapter 12, which we had elucidated from the ancient Sumerian epic of Gilgamesh, ancient kings had asserted the right to any maiden in their kingdom to take them for themselves. This is also found later, even in the kingdom of Israel. In 2 Samuel chapter 11, we read of David, king of Israel, and it came to pass in an eventide that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman washing herself. And the woman was very beautiful to look upon. And David sent and inquired after the woman. And one said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" And Uriah was not a Hittite by race. The word Hittite also means fearsome, and Uriah was a mighty warrior. So that should have been translated in the King James Version, Uriah the Fearsome, because he was clearly of the children of Israel. And David sent messengers and took her, and she came in unto him, and he lay with her, for she was purified from her uncleanness. And she returned unto her house. David would never have been able to do this and get away with it, which is to take a married woman from her house and lay with her, except that he was a king. And it is also fully evident that Bathsheba had no power to protest. So David, even a man after Yahweh's own heart, as it is attested in Acts chapter 13, in a moment of weakness, had taken a married woman, betrothed woman, because the same word is used to describe marriage and betrothal. We're not 100% certain that Uriah had consummated his marriage. But he took her, and legally, the consequences are the same, unless you're a king. simply because he found her desirable, because he lusted after her. In the law, the consequences are the same for a man who rapes a married woman and a man who rapes a betrothed woman. It's death by stoning either way. Or for a man who was found in adultery with a married woman or a betrothed woman, it's death by stoning either way. But David was the king, so he could get away with it. He was rebuked by the prophet Nathan and punished by God to some degree, but being king, he was not punished by men. Later, David would have several wives, Abigail, Ahinoam, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, as well as Bathsheba, and 10 concubines. That's recorded in 1 Samuel chapters 25 and 15. But after him, and in much greater excess, Solomon his son was said to have 700 wives and 300 concubines, as is related in 1 Kings chapter 11. Surely, as it was in the case of Bathsheba, and also in the cases of Sarah and Rebekah, not many of them could have had a choice in the matter. As we see here in Genesis with Hagar, a concubine was no better off than a slave. As for Sarah, she is 89 years old at this point in Genesis, and she must have still been quite attractive in spite of her advanced age. I made the quip that Sarah was the first recorded gilf in history, and that's somewhat profane and disrespectful, but she's 89 years old, and she's still an object of the desire of these men. She's not a grandmother yet. She's not even a mother yet. While we do not know the age of this Abimelech, he obviously had no qualms with having had sexual relations with such a woman, although he could not have been aware of her age when he took her. Believing that she was Abraham's sister, he may have even thought that she was still a virgin, since a woman who never married would be kept in the care of a brother or another male relative once her father died. While she may or may not have been pregnant with child already, as she was promised a child within a year, not long before Sodom had been destroyed, it is certainly too soon for it to have been apparent that she was pregnant. However, in Genesis chapter 21, we read, "For Sarah conceived and bare Abraham a son in his old age, at the set time of which God had spoken to him." But that does not necessarily mean that Sarah had not conceived until after this event had happened, although it does seem to indicate as much. Now, once again, Yahweh God intervenes on behalf of Abraham and Sarah, but in a different way than he had with Pharaoh. Verse 3, Genesis chapter 20. "But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, 'Behold, thou art but a dead man, for the woman which thou hast taken, for she is a man's wife.'" As it is described in Genesis chapter 12, Yahweh had plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. So in Egypt, although Yahweh had apparently plagued the Pharaoh without giving him any warning or any other communication, Pharaoh himself had nevertheless realized that he must have been plagued by some god on account of the woman whom he had taken. But here Yahweh seems to be more merciful upon Abimelech, warning him without having first caused him any harm. Where Abimelech answers, it is evident that his perspective of the power of God is far different than the Christian perspective. But Abimelech, verse 4, had not come near her, and he said, "Lord," the word Adon, "wilt thou slay also a righteous nation?" Adon being a term of respect, which can also be translated as Lord or Master. In the Septuagint, the end of this verse in Brenton's translation portrays Abimelech as having asked, Will thou destroy an ignorantly sinning and just nation? Or righteous, if you will. However, in the Greek of the passage, there is no word for sinning. So it should only be read, wilt thou destroy an ignorant and just nation? The Latin of the Vulgate reads that clause in the same manner, without a word for sinning. Wilt thou destroy an ignorant and just nation? And here it is apparent that to Abimelech, his death would have necessitated the death of the entire nation, referring to the people of Gerar. But the Philistines were pagans, and they did not know Yahweh. So it follows that he could not have understood that Yahweh God, being the true and almighty God, could have had him killed without destroying his nation with some calamity or with some invasion of a more powerful force to defeat him. The pagan perspective is materialist in nature. And that is also reflected by this statement by Abimelech here. It reflects the understanding that if he had not checked his covetousness and restrained his concupiscence that first night, the consequences would have been the destruction of himself and his entire nation, which he had considered a righteous nation from his own perspective. There had been nations which had evidently been destroyed for such covetousness, the foremost example of them being ancient Troy. The Trojan War was said to have been provoked when Alexandros, or Paris as the Romans had called him, had visited with Menelaus, the king of Sparta, a guest in his home. And when Menelaus was distracted, Alexandros took his wife, Helen of Troy, for himself, and he left with her. This act of adultery was said to have broken a covenant of peace between the Achaeans and the Trojans, whereby the Achaeans had no choice but to punish them with war. More recently, a long-time love affair between Mark Antony and Cleopatra of Egypt was a significant factor in the Roman civil war, which they waged together against Octavian, whose sister had been married to the unfaithful Antony. With their loss at the Battle of Actium, 300 years of Macedonian rule came to an end as Egypt was reduced to an imperial Roman province, becoming a personal possession of Octavian. Now Abimelech continues his defense. Said he not unto me, she is my sister? And she, even she herself said, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and innocency of my hands have I done this. While Abimelech was, of course, correct that he was led to believe that Sarah was unmarried, this nevertheless elucidates his belief that he could, with integrity, fulfill his lustful covetousness for any woman that he wished, so long as she was not married, and regardless of what the father or brother of the woman or the woman herself may have thought of it. He took Sarah not only without Abraham's approval, but even without asking Abraham for his approval, because he was king and had the ability to do that within his own kingdom. Of course, he may not have done that to the sister of another king, fearing war. But Abraham, even with all his servants, was visibly not as powerful as any neighboring king. Therefore, from the perspective of the pagan king Abimelech, covetousness has no consequences, unless perhaps the object of his desire turns out to have been married, and then he may have a fear of his God. Yahweh God must have known that, And therefore, when he spoke to Abimelech, he said, "Behold, thou art but a dead man for the woman which thou hast taken, for she is a man's wife." So Yahweh must have known that even Abimelech would have understood that to have that circumstance to have been a transgression worthy of death, even the death of a king or an entire nation. We can only wonder how many adulterers have died throughout history. And the actual cause of death was never even realized by men. Verse 6, "And God said unto him in a dream, Yeah, I know that thou did this in the integrity of thy heart, for I also withheld thee from sinning against me. Therefore suffered I thee not to touch her." So Yahweh judged Abimelech by his own standards, by Abimelech's own standards. Much later, Yahshua Christ is recorded in Matthew chapter 7 as having said, "For with what judgment you judge, you shall be judged, and with what measure ye meet," or dish out, in other words, "it shall be measured to you again." Here Yahweh followed that same principle, of course, while also displaying his mercy upon Abimelech, as Yahweh himself takes credit that Abimelech had not yet violated Sarah. As Paul of Tarsus implies in Romans chapter 1, Yahweh may keep us from sin, but he may also give us up to sin as a punishment for abandoning him. Here it is made evident that he deals with pagans, even those such as Abimelech, who certainly had never had any opportunity to know him in that same manner. Abimelech himself was a descendant of Mitzrayim, the son of Ham, since he was a Philistine. Although it is apparent that the Philistines and Egyptians themselves had not remembered their ancient relationship to one another, in Genesis chapter 10 we read, "And Mitzrayim begat Ludim, and Anamim, and Lahabim, and Naphtuhim." All these Eams are actually tribes of people and not merely individuals. "And Casluhim, out of whom came Philistine, and Kaphtorim." With this, it is also evident that at one time, and I believe I mentioned this earlier in Genesis, descendants of Ham had inhabited the entire Mediterranean coast of Africa, Egypt, and the Levant, as far north as Hamath, and also much of central and eastern Anatolia. They inhabited perhaps half of the territory surrounding the coasts of the Mediterranean Sea. Now Yahweh instructs Abimelech to correct his unintentional error. "Now therefore restore the man, his wife, for he is a prophet, and he shall pray for thee, and thou shalt live. And if thou restore her not, know that thou shalt surely die, thou and all that are thine." Here Abraham is reckoned among the prophets in the sense of one who receives, interprets, and applies the word of God. But in the actions of his life, he also transmitted to men the will of God, even if he did not put it to writing. Now, however, it was that Yahweh had spoken to Abimelech. His subsequent actions certainly indicate that he believed the God which had spoken to him. And in that context, I write God with a small g, because I'm certain that Abimelech really didn't know one God from another. Therefore, Abimelech rose early in the morning and called his servants and told all these things in their ears, and the men were sore afraid. The name Abimelech must have actually been used as a title by the kings of the Philistines, so it's not really a personal name, as there are several kings who were so named as late as the time of David in 2 Samuel chapter 11. It is a Hebrew phrase from words which literally mean father, he, and king in that order, and is interpreted to mean father of the king in Strong's original concordance, but in later sources, my father is king. Either way, it seems to imply the hope a man would have that his son would be king after him. Here it is apparent that Abimelech believed this God who had spoken to him to such a degree that he had no problem relating the experience to his entire household without hesitation, ostensibly in order to explain what he was about to do and convey the message that they would follow suit so that no harm would come to Abraham. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said unto him, "What hast thou done unto us? And what have I offended thee, that thou hast brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? Thou hast done deeds unto me that ought not to be done." And Abimelech said unto Abraham, "What sorrowest thou that thou hast done this thing?" It seems that Abimelech took it for granted that Abraham should have been honest with him. So he wanted an explanation from Abraham as to why he was not. The Pharaoh of Egypt responded in much the same way in Genesis chapter 12, where we read, "And Pharaoh called Abram and said, What is this that thou hast done unto me? Why did thou not tell me that she was thy wife? Why sayest thou, She is my sister? So I might have taken her to me to wife. Now therefore, behold thy wife, take her and go thy way." Abraham's answer to Pharaoh was not recorded, if indeed he had given one, while here it is recorded from verse 11. And Abraham said, "Because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and it will slay me for my wife's sake. And yet indeed she is my sister. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife." While Abraham did not lie, except by omission, here he explained why he did not tell the entire truth. For fear that the men of Gerar had no fear of a god. The men of Sodom evidently had no fear of a god. Why would Gerar be any different? If men do not fear any god, as even many pagan nations had feared the imagined wrath of their own pagan idols, then they are free to construct their own concepts of righteousness, where only might becomes right. As Solomon had explained of the wicked in his wisdom, so he portrayed the wicked as having believed that they would have no consequences for their covetousness, where he wrote in Wisdom chapter 2, putting these words into their mouths, "For our time is a very shadow that passes away, and after our end there is no returning. For it is fast sealed so that no man comes again." No man can return to this life after he dies. "Come on, therefore, let us enjoy the good things that are present, and let us speedily use the creatures, like as in youth. Let us fill ourselves with costly wine and ointments, and let no flower of the spring pass by us, rape every virgin. Let us crown ourselves with rosebuds before they be withered, and let none of us go without his part of our voluptuousness. Let us leave tokens of our joyfulness in every place. For this is our portion, our lot is this. Let us oppress the poor righteous man. Let us not spare the widow, nor reverence the gray hairs of the aged. Let our strength be the law of justice. For that which is feeble is found to be nothing worth," or to be worth nothing, of course. "The wicked, having no fear of any god, imagine that might is right, so that they may do what thou wilt." Mantras which have been adopted by many pagans today. This certainly reflects the experience of Lot in Sodom, and may be why Abraham may have thought that the same circumstances would be found in Gerar. We do not know to what degree, if at all, any of the descendants of Noah may have maintained any memory of the God of Noah. As I discussed earlier, they certainly would have been ingrained throughout the generations with some form of morality, which Noah had also exhibited in his lifetime. Noah would have passed that to his sons, who would have passed it to their sons, who would have passed it to their sons. Ultimately, some of them would have lost it along the way and taken after the ways of the heathen, the Rephaim, the Canaanites, the other mixed and non-Adamic people of the time. In our chronology of Genesis, at this point, it is now 1,330 years since the flood of Noah had come to an end. But using the generic term God, as Abraham had only known the Almighty God by that title, the concept of a God may evoke thoughts of any God or any peculiar God which may have been worshipped by any particular individual listener. To Abimelech, it may have evoked thoughts of Dagon, although there is no indication that he thought it was Dagon who had spoken to him. If one says God to a Chinaman, it may evoke images of his idol, Buddha, or to an Indian, his idol, Vishnu. But if one says God to many Americans, it might evoke images of their idol, Donald Trump. Yes, that may be sarcasm, but it is nonetheless true. Abraham continues his explanation, verse 13. And it came to pass, when God caused me to wander from my father's house, that I said unto her, this is thy kindness which thou shalt show unto me. At every place whither we shall come, say of me, he is my brother. So Abimelech seems to have had a greater degree of decency than that of Pharaoh. Yahweh God did not have to plague Abimelech in order to make him realize that he was wrong and that he could kill him or even destroy his entire nation if he had so desired. Additionally, Abimelech is portrayed as having had more humility than Pharaoh as he listened to Abraham explain himself and his experience. Now he further goes so far as to make gifts to Abraham, which is far beyond any obligation that he had to him, as he had only been told by God to return Sarah to Abraham. So Abimelech must have been pleased with Abraham's explanation, and being of good character, seemingly, he also shows respect for Abraham's God. And Abimelech took sheep and oxen and men servants and women servants and gave them unto Abraham and restored him Sarah, his wife. The Septuagint has 1,000 pieces of silver in addition to these other gifts which Abraham received from Abimelech, which are also mentioned in verse 16. Here we should also note that no portion of Genesis chapter 20 has evidently survived in the copies of Genesis found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, so we cannot examine those as a witness. Abraham must have still had a quite large household of his own, which is evident in the portrayal of the life of Isaac, where in Genesis chapter 25 we read, "And Abraham gave all that he had unto Isaac." Then in Genesis chapter 26, we read in part, "Then Isaac sowed in that land, and received in the same year 100-fold, and Yahweh blessed him. And a man waxed great, and went forward until he became very great. For he had possession of flocks, and possession of herds, and a great store of servants. And the Philistines envied him. Later, as it is also recorded in that chapter, Isaac would have trouble with the Philistines on account of their envy, of their covetousness, I should say. But the point here is that Abraham had need of none and would not take any gifts from the king of Sodom earlier in chapter 14 of Genesis. So perhaps Abraham noticed a difference in the character of these two men, that he did graciously take gifts from Abimelech. He accepted his gifts. Yet here Abimelech makes Abraham an even more generous and flattering, even flattering offer. I should have written a more generous and even flattering offer, because it is. And Abimelech said, "Behold, my land is before thee. Dwell where it pleaseth thee." And unto Sarah he said, "Behold, I have given thy brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, he is to thee a covering of the eyes unto all that are with thee, and with all others." Thus she was reproved, and I don't like most of that translation, or at least much of it. Ostensibly, Abimelech remembered that the God who visited him had called Abraham a prophet and sought to ingratiate himself with him. However, there is no evident motive beyond piety. The word translated as reproved here, yakak, basically means to be right, as it is defined in Strong's original concordance, or to justify, decide, or convict, depending on the context in which it is used. So the word does not necessarily have such a negative connotation as reprove does today. In the New American Standard Bible, the final clause of this verse is translated much better in this context, as, and before all men you are cleared. In other words, Sarah was taken by Abimelech into his own house. But once he found that she was a married woman, never having touched her, he informed his staff, and now he returns her, acknowledging that Abraham was indeed her husband, and with language indicating that she herself was innocent of any wrongdoing. The lengthier clause, rather than the clause which reads here, "Behold, he is to thee a covering of the eyes unto all that are with thee, and with all other," and the King James has italics there, so that word "other" doesn't even exist. "Thus she was reproved." Instead of that, Brenton's translation of the Septuagint, referring to the silver, has, "Those shall be to thee for the price of thy countenance, and to all the women with thee, and speak the truth in all things." And that last clause is basically horrible. Some of these differences may be resolved where the New American Standard Version has a better rendering of the Hebrew. I should say the New American Standard Bible, or NASB as it calls itself. Evidently, they understood the idioms better than the translators of the King James Version had understood them. Where it reads, "To Sarah he said, 'Look, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It is your vindication before all who are with you, and before everyone you are cleared.'" However, the phrase "it is your vindication" may more likely and more properly have been read, "He is your vindication." So I have issues with every translation, but the least number of issues with the New American Standard Bible, at least in this passage. And of course, "he is your vindication" is a reference to Abraham. So Sarah is vindicated. Abimelech is shown to have been a righteous man, at least within his own pagan perspective. And in this case, something good comes out of the consequences of his covetousness. Since with the grace and mercy of God, he had refrained from fulfilling his lusty desires. So now Abraham responds in kind. So Abraham prayed unto God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maidservants, and they bare children. For Yahweh had fast closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Ostensibly, the maidservants of Abimelech would also be his concubines, as this passage implies. This passage seems to indicate that a more considerable length of time had elapsed here, enough time for him to notice that his wives and concubines were not getting pregnant when they had been expected to do so. In those days, it was typical for men of substance to have multiple wives, concubines, and many children, which is somewhat evident in the lives of Abraham, Jacob, and even Esau. Perhaps, while the actual time which Abimelech had custody of Sarah was no more than one night, which the text seems to indicate, from the time that Sarah had been returned to the point where the women are once again fertile may have been a much longer period. And this passage is merely acknowledging that circumstance. That would also serve as an indication to Abimelech that the decision which he made to comply with the God that had spoken to him was the correct choice to make, as it demonstrates that he is God and Abraham is his prophet, as he was told. Evidently, Abraham remained in Gerar in peace, although Isaac had troubles later in Genesis with a king of Gerar who must have been a successor to this Abimelech, but who had retained that same title. Where that event is described in Genesis chapter 26, it is evident that Isaac was nearly 100 years old when those things happened. Here, he is not even yet born. This concludes our commentary on Genesis through Genesis chapter 20. Thank you for listening. Praise Yahweh God, the God of Israel, and good night.